Chapter 11. Drua, Moon of Almania. In the silvery light of dawn, Ben stood under a sidewalk cafe awning beside a nearly deserted city street and stared up at the soaring Crossroads business habitat. It was unlovely in the extreme, a greenish column extending 800 meters up into the sky, with decorative yellow-white structures like planetary rings situated every 5 floors. At least Ben hoped they were decorative. What their function might be otherwise was beyond him. Could they slide up and down the building exterior like massive open-air turbolifts? The data card Siha had given him included a data file on Drua, including a mention that the Crossroads building was one of the system's few acknowledgments that there was life outside Almania. Trang Robotics, one of the system's largest industries, traded a tremendous number of computer systems and droids to the Alliance, the Chiss, and other large collectives of planets and cultures. But the locals, by and large, ignored the fact that anything existed beyond their star system. The occasional firm like Crossroads seemed to exist principally to rub such unwelcome news into the faces of the Almanians. The building housed the local offices of hundreds of off-world firms as they tried, usually successfully, to arrange for advantageous purchase deals from local technological firms, or attempted, usually unsuccessfully, to market their own goods in this system. At this early hour, there was already a stream of workers entering the ground-level doors of the Crossroads building. Most looked to Ben as though they were off-worlders like himself. At some point, he would have to join them, go up to the 215th floor, find and break into the display case, replace the real amulet there with the fake he carried in his pocket, and get out undetected. No, that was too much, he decided. For once it was his mother's voice, and not Jason's, that whispered in his ear. The first step in any intelligence operation, she had told him more than once, is gathering information. You gather enough information to make your plan. If you're planning without information, you're planning for failure.
But that's not how the Jedi do things, Bennett protested. They just go there and solve the problem.
She'd given him a crafty smile.
Which is why they're famous, right?
Right.
Well, when intelligence operatives do their jobs correctly, they never become famous, because no one ever learns they've been there. And sometimes that's what solving the problem means.
Ben hadn't liked the answer then, because it seemed to preclude igniting lightsabers, bouncing off walls, and stuffing the smiles of bad people straight down their mouths. But now he could see that the intelligence way had merit from time to time. Jason did things that couldn't always appear on news holocausts. Jason's duties seemed to be about half intelligence these days. Suddenly, in Ben's estimation, Mara got a lot smarter. So he'd do an information-gathering run, and then decide, when he knew more, whether to continue straight into the actual mission, or back off and return at a later time. The wall behind him slid up, revealing the cafe's interior. Warm air smelling of fresh-baked goods rolled across Ben, and he abruptly realized that he was hungry. The proprietor, a tall man with the build and gut of a Gamorrean, stepped out among his tables, looked up and down at the sidewalk foot traffic, and glanced at Ben.
"Here to eat, son?"
To Ben's ears, his quaint accent made it sound like, "Here to eat, son?" Ben nodded. The man tapped a tabletop, motioning for Ben to sit there. The tabletop lit up, 4 points on it revealing themselves to be displays showing the establishment's morning menu. Ben sat and looked it over, while also watching the front of his target building, noticing the way many people heading toward the building instead veered toward the cafe.
"Calf, please," Ben said, "and cruffy pot pie."
"Tap it out, son, and put in your cred card. No mistakes that way."
The proprietor tapped his ear, as if suggesting he were hard of hearing.
"You sound Coruscanti,"
Ben entered his order and slid his cred card into the slot at the table center.
I am. Mostly.
Two kinds of Coruscanti there are. Those that are happy for big open spaces, and those who can't stand not being surrounded by close walls and tight streets.
I suppose so.
The table surface went ding, and the word declined in red was superimposed over the menu. Below it, more text read, Account not found. Please insert another cred card.
Hey, Ben said, your table is broken.
The proprietor moved over to look. He pointed at a symbol at the menu's lower left corner, an animation of tiny blaster bolts crisscrossing, right to left and left to right.
No, Holocom data link's live. That means it's checking all the way back to wherever your account's supposed to be. And there's no account to find. Got another cred card? Or coin?
Ben felt in his pocket. There was one cred coin there. His last. He'd planned to get local coins through his cred card. He shook his head. The proprietor gave him a sympathetic look.
Well, go ask your mother or father for more.
The hunger Ben was feeling was graduating from mild to sharp and painful.
Maybe, he said, you could let me have my breakfast, and I'd get Dad to pay you back later today.
To his suggestion, he added a sizable push through the force. The proprietor laughed.
I could, but after a year of doing that, I'd be out of business. Off with you, son.
Ben sighed and left the table. He really was hungry now, and perhaps, he reflected, the hunger had kept him from concentrating and being able to affect the man. Or maybe Ben was just too weak because, like his father said, he hadn't had sufficient Jedi training. Or maybe the proprietor was too strong-willed. It didn't matter. Ben resisted the urge to stomp his frustrations away as he left the cafe. And now his plans needed further revision. Before reconnaissance, he needed food. And he needed to find out what had become of the special account that was supposed to be available to him for this mission. Banking kiosks turned out to be no help. Twice he inserted his cred card in their slots and tried to access his account. But all he received was a cryptic account not found screen. He tried to send a message to the establishment, but even a tiny data query would cost money if sent over a Holocom connection, and he had no money to draw on. Well, that had to change. He had to, as his mother had put it so many times, acquire resources. And in this situation, that meant stealing. He hesitated over that. Stealing was wrong. Sure, everybody in his family had hijacked ships at one time or another, but those were always emergencies. Nobody stole for breakfast credits. But this wasn't just breakfast credits. He was on a mission, one he was proud to have been assigned, one that was important and might save the lives of Jedi and guards. Didn't that make it an emergency? He decided it did. He drifted across the street to stand near the doors into the Crossroads building. Perhaps someone would flash a cred card. Ben would see where he pocketed it, and he could follow the owner. And what? He didn't have his mother's skills. He couldn't pick someone's pocket clean without that person feeling it. He could follow his target into a lonely corridor or alley, hit him over the head. But Ben's already upset stomach rebelled at that notion. Suddenly he was a mugger, injuring or possibly killing someone in an effort to obtain pocket credits. He shook his head. Hitting someone over the head for breakfast credits would be a mistake, and he couldn't afford to make a mistake right now. The answer came to him a moment later. A public conveyance airspeeder, striped red and yellow to make it even more conspicuous than the glow-dot marquee reading "For Hire" on the hood, pulled to a landing in front of the building, and its driver hopped out to open a front-end cargo compartment and offload luggage. The passenger exited and waited on the walkway, a small portfolio of black simulated Nerf leather open in his hand. and tucked into many of the numerous little pockets of that portfolio, Ben saw, were cred cards. Some were banking institution cred cards, the sort that required validation from the institution to access funds, but others were stamped to indicate that they carried their own value in their memory. Ben knew what he could do. He drifted closer. When the driver was finished and three pieces of luggage rested on the walkway, the passenger handed him one of the institutional cards. At that moment, Ben flicked a finger and exerted himself through the force. One of the other cards, the lesser ones, leapt free of the portfolio and fluttered to the street. Ben edged closer and pinned the card to the ground with his mental exertion. A moment later, the driver handed the other card back to the passenger, entered the driver's compartment, and accelerated away. The passenger pocketed his portfolio, clumsily picked up the luggage, and moved on into the Crossroads building. Ben moved over beside the street, knelt as if to fiddle with his boot, and picked up the card. And that was it. He was a thief, but he'd only taken a little bit of what the man possessed, and had hurt no one. He'd made the wrong as small as he possibly could. Half an hour later, well fed on calf and cruffy pot pie, which turned out to be savory fowl meat, vegetables, and gravy in a thick pastry shell, he felt ready to put his troubles behind him and get the mission underway. A few minutes with his data pad, communicating with a public data terminal, gave him some of the information he needed. Tendrando Arms leased the 212th through 215th floors. That suggested to Ben that the floor he wanted, 215, was where the most important employees had their offices. His mother had told him on numerous occasions that one way people liked to feel important was by sitting on top of their subordinates, and the practical way to do this was to have their offices on upper floors. Since the building had its decorative planetary rings every five stories, starting with the sixth story, then 215 had to be just beneath one of those rings. Ben searched the building directory and found that Lister Innovations leased the next three floors, 216 through 218. Lister Innovations' public records indicated that the firm employed quality specialists and idea generators who would visit other companies and tell them how to do their jobs better. Ben frowned over that, dubious, but decided that descending from 216 might be the easiest way to get onto 215 unobserved. He occupied himself for another hour researching Tendrando Arms' local office and Lister Innovations, then spent the rest of the morning and some of the afternoon buying things, food and bottled liquids that would not rapidly deteriorate, 20 meters of thin, pliant, strong cable, basic mechanical tools, a box of sweets, a length of red ribbon, and a large backpack. The last of the credits on the card he'd stolen went to buying himself a hot midday meal. As the workday grew late and workers began streaming out of the Crossroads building in anticipation of shift change, Ben entered the building, backpack on his shoulders and ribbon-wrapped box of sweets in his hands, and took the turbo lift up to 216. The doors opened into a jungle. Ben stared at healthy trees growing up out of dark, moist-looking soil, smelled the warm, heavy air of a tropical rainforest, saw a distant solar light through the trees that was a whiter hue than Almania's sun. Somewhere in the distance, water splashed. There was no sound of industry, of harassed workers, of overtaxed terminals. He stepped out onto the jungle floor, and the turbo lift doors closed behind him. He turned to look at them and saw only a sheer rock face. It was a perfect illusion. When he tried to examine it through the force, he could sense very little. The trees did not resonate with life. He could detect no movement of insects through the air or underneath the soil. He grinned toward the trees. "It's all mechanical," he told himself.
"So it is."
The voice, male, came from only a few meters ahead.
"Follow the path, please."
The path, the ground and leaves underfoot convincingly soft and resilient, led forward, then curved right, revealing a clearing that should have been visible from the turbolift, but was not. The right half of the clearing was dominated by a stone-lined pool, seemingly natural, into which water from an adjacent waterfall splashed. Next to it was a desk apparently made of black stone. As it came into view, the man who sat behind it, young and pale-skinned, lowered his lizard-skin boots from the desktop and sat forward in a more normal pose. His jumpsuit, though apparently cloth, had the same color and texture as his boots.
"Welcome to Lister Innovations," he said. "Can I help you?"
"What is all this?" Ben asked, gesturing around.
"Corporate culture."
The man offered Ben a big, practiced smile to go with his big, practiced words.
"One of the things we do is show companies how to establish and maintain their own cultural identities through environmental design. Here in our receiving area, the floor, walls, and decorative pillars are made of or coated with our patented chameleon cover material, which allows the ultimate in decorative versatility. With just a few words, I can establish a new tone, a new work environment. For instance, decor, purity."
He'd hardly finished the second word when a change rippled through the chamber. Trees straightened, becoming vertical, absolutely symmetrical, their branches folding up into their sides. The floor flattened into a perfect plane, and Ben, balancing, could feel it harden under his feet. Most objects faded to white smoothness, the trees becoming featureless and gleaming. Even the man's clothes transformed from their green scale texture to pure white. His desk became silver, and the rim of stones around the pool became a silvery seating bench. Now Ben could see the true dimensions of the room. For a reception area, it was large, about 20 meters by 20, but it no longer seemed to stretch forever in every direction. Silvery panels on the walls, doors, he supposed, showed him where the boundaries were. The man was watching him closely, and Ben did not need to tap into the force to feel that he wanted Ben to be impressed. "He lives for praise," Ben thought. "And Jason says that when you give people what they want, they can be more cooperative."
"Wow," Ben said. "I mean, wow." "Wow, indeed."
The man smiled, apparently satisfied.
"So, are you looking for someone in particular?"
"Oh, yeah."
Ben pretended to consult his datapad.
"I have something for, Gilthor Breen."
"I'm Gilthor Breen."
"I know that," Ben thought. "Your face and your name are on the company's public page, and a whole long list of your likes and dislikes."
"Then this is for you."
He put the beribboned box on the desktop. Gilthor looked closely at Ben, then subjected the box to the same scrutiny. He pulled the ribbon end to untie the bow, then opened the box and gave a brief, uncertain smile when he saw the variety of sweets within.
Is there a note?"
Ben checked his datapad again.
"No note. She just left a short message. 2 days.
2 days? She? Who's she? What's her name?"
Ben shrugged.
"She didn't leave one, but she was very short, with long black hair and black eyes. And cute, really cute."
This was a description of Aliniaka Vare, a young holodrama actress currently in vogue. She was from the world of Balmora, like Gilthor himself, and she was his favorite actress. 3 facts that Ben had found on Gilthor's personal page. Ben wasn't going to try to persuade Gilthor that his admirer was Vare herself. It just seemed reasonable that if Gilthor admired Vare, he'd also be interested in a woman who looked like her. Apparently, he'd guessed correctly. Gilthor practically began to vibrate in his chair.
2 days, he said. "Until what?
Maybe she'll be in touch again."
"That's it."
Abruptly realizing that Ben was still present, he dug into a pocket and drew out a cred coin.
Thanks. You're welcome. Can I use your refresher?
Of course, of course. Decor, refresher.
A melodious droid voice to Ben's left said,
Here I am.
And when Ben glanced toward it, he saw that one of the silver panels was now cycling between silver and black. Ben smiled and trotted that way.
He spent little time in the refresher, just long enough to determine that its jet-black tiled floor and blue-tiled walls seemed content to stay in their respective colors, and that there were exterior windows on one wall. That's what he needed to know. Moments later, he trotted out to the silvery turbolift access and waved goodbye to Gilthor. The man gave him a distracted nod and spoke a couple of words Ben couldn't hear. The lift doors opened. Now was the moment of truth. Ben took half a step forward, but did not quite enter the turbolift. He concentrated on Gilthor and imagined, in some detail and with great conviction, himself getting aboard. As the doors closed, he tried to project the image of the doors closing with him on the other side.
I got on the turbolift, he thought. Think about the girl.
Gilthor leaned back in his chair and put his feet up again. He seemed to be whistling. Slowly, quietly, Ben moved at a crouch back toward the refresher.
I got on. I went away. I'm gone.
By the time he reached the refresher door again, he was sweating through his garments. But Gilthor never looked his way. Ben set himself up in one of the stalls, hand-lettering a sign that read, In need of repair. Maintenance has been summoned. Repairs scheduled for tomorrow. This he placed on the front of the stall, and he kept his force senses and more ordinary senses sharp, straining to hear or feel anyone who might approach this refresher chamber. But no one did, and he could feel Gilthor outside, seated at his desk. He could also feel a steady stream of life moving up and down the turbolift, mostly down as the offices were depopulated by the late hour. But no one came to this refresher before Ben was done. With his tools, Ben unscrewed one viewport panel from the wall and carried all his equipment through it to rest on the planetary ring structure beyond. Twilight was gathering outside, and from here Ben could see all the lights of the city, the majority of them pale blue, pale green, or white, a striking difference from the nighttime skies of Coruscant in all their spectral beauty. The decorative ring turned out to be made of plasteel, mounted sturdily to the building exterior. It shifted not at all under the occasional breeze. A gap of about 10 centimeters separated it from the building edge, and through the gap Ben could see the regularly spaced mounting struts that held the ring to the building exterior. Though in the growing darkness Ben didn't think he could be seen, he kept his movements to a minimum as he repositioned the transparisteel panel he'd removed and carefully dogged it back into place. Then he knotted the cable he'd brought at 1 meter intervals. He tied it at about the middle around one of the support struts visible through the gap. He threaded one half down through the gap, tossing the other over the edge. Carefully, he lowered himself over the edge and climbed down the cable. This put him directly opposite one of the viewports of the Tendrondo Arms offices. It was only dimly lit, and hanging there, Ben could see it was furnished mostly with sturdy-looking stand-up lockers as tall as a human man. Weapons lockers, he guessed, given that Tendrondo was an arms manufacturing firm, and wondered if he should help himself to a weapon or two. But he shook his head. Jedi weren't supposed to need anything but their lightsabers, except when they piloted warcraft, of course. He descended a few more meters on his cable, bringing him down opposite the 214th floor, and began shifting his weight, causing him to swing toward the building wall and the other half of the cable dangling there. After a few moments, his swings brought him close enough to that cable to grab it. He let go of the first one, leaving him dangling next to the building wall, and climbed back up to 215. Leaning in close to the viewport, he could see the mechanical control that opened the viewport from within. It seemed from this angle to be a simple hand crank, but its handle was now folded against its shaft, and the control itself was snugly fitted within a small transparisteel cylinder, with a mechanical lock holding the cylinder to the apparatus. Ben studied it for a few moments and decided he understood its workings. With the handle up against the shaft and the smooth transparisteel cylinder in the way, an ordinary person's grip strength could probably not develop the torque necessary to open the window. He half-closed his eyes and concentrated on the apparatus. He reached out to it through the force, gripping it as he'd grip his lightsaber hilt to yank it to him, and twisted. It didn't budge. He tried the other direction. Now it did move, a few degrees of arc. He frowned, concentrating harder, and the crank began to rotate very slowly. It was hard work. As it moved, a tiny gap appeared at the top of the viewport, and it widened. 1 centimeter, 2. Ben's grip slipped, and he fell. Ben grabbed frantically, wrapped one arm around the cable, felt its knots bumping their way past his elbow hard enough to leave bruises. He tightened his grip, grabbed with his free hand and the force, and arrested his fall, the impact of his stop yanking both arms to full, painful extension. He gulped for a few moments, then looked down. He'd fallen only 2 stories. There was still more cable beneath him. He hadn't grabbed the very end. And 2 stories down was the next decorative ring. Had he missed the cable altogether, he would have hit that. Possibly not even with enough force and noise to alert every security officer within a kilometer. Possibly. Half dreading what he might see, he looked into the viewport where he now found himself, expecting to peer into the alarmed faces of office workers. But instead, he saw an unoccupied chamber, a combination lounge and kitchen. He gulped in a few breaths, then climbed back up, furious at himself. His concentration on the force had been so great that he'd lost focus on his hands. He couldn't afford to do that. He'd get himself killed. When he reached the viewport again, he spent a few moments tying the cable around his waist, with a knot he could undo with just a pull, then got back to work. In a couple of minutes, the viewport was open enough to admit him. He scrambled through, pulled the release length of cable, and dropped to the floor. He was happy. He could relax for a moment, and all he had to do at this point was make a covert search of the offices, find the display case, swap the amulet, and make his way to the ground again. Easy. Ben looked at the display case, and his heart sank. It hadn't taken long to find. The Tendrando offices all seemed to have been emptied by the hour, so there were no people to dodge. The display case was not in any of the individual executives' offices, but in the central chamber, dominated by a big desk and a receptionist protocol droid whose optics were unlit, indicating that it was in sleep mode. The chamber itself contained a dozen or so displays, chiefly statuettes and plaques commemorating unusually advantageous business deals made on Drua. Some of the items were unusual presents given to the local office, such as a set of tiny acrobat droids, each no taller than Ben's hand was wide, even now doing tumbling routines on their shelf of the display case. But the transparisteel top had been carefully removed from the display case, and the amulet of Kalara was gone. The red velvet pillow it had rested on was still there, as was the silver-on-black sign next to it. Amulet of Kalara, presented to Stonius Leem by the grateful victors of the insurrection of Iliabeth. But there was no amulet on the pillow itself. Instead, there was a hand-lettered piece of flimsy. It read, "I will return the amulet to where it belongs. Be grateful that I spared your lives." It was signed, Fascus of Zeost. There was something else in the case, too. It was a trace of emotion Ben could detect through the force, a sensation of happiness, glee. The gloating of a Sith lifetime had to have infused the amulet, and a little of that emotion had been left behind in the case. Ben sat on the carpet and tried to sort out what it all meant. Someone else had stolen the amulet he meant to steal. That wasn't fair. And it had to have been done recently, within the last couple of hours. If it had been done yesterday or earlier, the local authorities would have been here to investigate already, and the case wouldn't have looked like this. It would be closed up, the piece of flimsy removed. Ben closed his eyes and tried to feel something, anything, about the theft. But he couldn't. There was no tragedy here to detect, no vast outpouring of emotion concerning the amulet. He could not see the perpetrator's face or get a sense of his spirit. And he could detect no one in these offices, meaning that the thief had already made good his escape. With only a few minutes' head start, he could be anywhere in the city. And he could have had much more than a few minutes. Ben opened his eyes and sighed. He'd failed. He'd failed Jason. And now all the Jedi were at risk. No, wait a minute. Maybe he hadn't. Not yet. Perhaps, instead of slinking home and admitting to failure, he could continue the mission, improvising. He might be able to follow this Fascus and take the amulet back from him. But where would Fascus take it? Ben took out his datapad and accessed files that he hadn't read before, those pertaining to the amulet's origin and history. The main file on the subject said that it had been fabricated on Zeost some 2,000 standard years ago, and that the dark side energies invested in it kept it from corroding or showing wear. Ben frowned. Jason didn't believe in dark side energies, or the dark side of the Force per se, and so Ben didn't either. But so many of the Jedi they dealt with were so old-fashioned on that point that Jason did grudgingly employ terms like light side and dark side to communicate with them effectively. Stolen by a man from Zeost, crafted on Zeost. Fascus was obviously going to take the amulet back to Zeost. Ben recognized the name of that planet, and it gave him a little shiver. Zeost was the homeworld of the Sith, the species that had given their name to the later order. In subsequent centuries, Sith referred to Force users of any species who followed the Order's traditions. His datapad yielded a little information on Zeost, and Ben was surprised to discover that, as galactic distances went, Zeost was not far from Almania, a few hours' ride away by shuttle. But no shuttles would be going there. Worlds noted for their inhospitable weather and ancient horrors just were not common tourist destinations. He'd have to acquire transport some other way. But what to do now? Leave the display case as he'd found it? Jason had said that his core mission was to put the amulet in his, Jason's, hands. If it were reported stolen, it might be harder to acquire. If the authorities picked up this Fascus of Zeost, it might be very hard indeed. Ben pulled his copy of the amulet from an inner pocket and laid it on the velvet pillow. He took several looks at the hollow of the real amulet on his datapad and was careful to arrange the fake and its chain on the pillow just as they appeared on the image. Then he took Fascus's note and remounted the display case top. There. Now no one would know that the real amulet had been stolen, unless they took out the fake and studied it. Maybe not even then. It was clear the local Tendrondo office had no idea what they'd had, and perhaps they'd never recorded enough information about it to tell the real one from a fake. Ben spent extra minutes covering his tracks. At the viewport by which he'd entered the offices, he used the Force to untie the cable and drag it into him. then closed the viewport again. Now there would be no sign that any unauthorized personnel had been there. He left the offices by the front way, summoned the turbo lift, and descended to street level. 2 minutes after Ben's departure, the protocol droid in the reception area came alive. Its optics lit up, and its head swiveled to look at the display case. The image its visual sensors picked up was compressed and transmitted over a specific comm frequency. Kilometers away, at the Drua spaceport, a 100-meter-long bulk freighter rested in one of the outlying hangars. In the days it had been in port, the inoffensive-looking vessel had attracted little attention, her minimal crew carrying on a small-scale disinterested trade in droids from discontinued lines. But the squat, inelegant vessel would have attracted more interest had anyone gone aboard to examine her. Inspectors would have found that half the cargo bays had been converted to starfighter bays, and that the black and bronze starfighters were well known on the space lanes as pirate vehicles. The freighter's name of record was false. Her transponder indicated that she was the High Tide, while her crew and victims knew her as the Boneyard Rendezvous. The comm board's computer received the distant droid's message, interpreted it, and popped a text message onto the display of its captain, whose name was Bjalfin Dure. Dure, an underfed-looking boffin with lovely bronze-colored fur, looked away from his holodrama and read aloud to the other crew members on the bridge.
"Red braid in motion. Tracker activated. Confirm handoff."
He sat back and sighed, glad that the stopover on this overly law-abiding moon would not be protracted. Here, too, his comm officer, tail gunner, and cook, a Rhodian who spent every spare credit having every fifth scale on his body dyed from a light green to a dark blue, giving him a curiously dotted appearance, jabbered a question.
"Yes, answer,"
Dure said.
"The captain and crew of the Boneyard Rendezvous acknowledge that your safe, undemanding part in this escapade is at an end, and accept handover of responsibility. Sleep untroubled, and know that parties far more interesting than you shall carry this torch evermore. Got it?"
Hirtu stared at him for a few moments. Then he typed "handover acknowledged" on his comm board and sent the message. Dure sighed and returned his attention to the holodrama.
"There is no immortal spark within you."
Hirtu nodded, admission that the captain was correct.
"Track the boy. I want to know where he is every minute of the day."